in foundational ways, but I am so far very concerned that the policies and actions he's putting forward in this election don't match his rhetoric. So what we're seeing is all of the major parties at the federal level offering income tax cuts to varying extents, and really a set of policy promises that, as if this was just any other election. Canadians are not being asked to sacrifice, because the short-term pain involved in really engaging the Trump regime in the way it should be engaged with as a hostile entity means that we should be treating this at least as seriously as we treated the pandemic on the economic side of things, in terms of supporting industries that are about to lose tens of thousands of jobs and supporting those individuals through that difficult time, supporting businesses so that some of them survive a trade war, and then long-term vision to actually pivot Canada along various dimensions away from the United States. Not even Pierre Poilievre is making promises remotely close to what they need to be to rebuild our military capacity in the events things keep getting worse and worse, let alone structural changes to the economy to make our relations with Europe and Japan and other Commonwealth countries like Australia and New Zealand and other democratic countries like South Korea, and get away from U.S. influence and control and make their threats, make us less vulnerable to their threats. I don't see any Canadian politician who seems genuinely serious about that prospect, about that mission. And I realize the worst time to get politicians to behave seriously is during an election campaign. I understand all of the political incentives, particularly for Mark Carney's Liberals that are in the lead right now as we speak, is they can't be the party finding ways to generate revenue for the government instead of offering tax cuts while all the other parties are offering Canadians tax cuts. I get the political incentives, but the mismatch between Carney's rhetoric on this and what he's putting forward in terms of policies is a pretty big gap right now that has me worried. I guess we'd have to wait to see a new government come in and see what it ultimately really decides to do and whether it is demonstrating the long-term thinking necessary for this. Because otherwise we are going to remain deeply vulnerable. And if the situation in the United States continues to deteriorate, we could be left in an existentially vulnerable position.
Yeah, and you're referring to the tax break policy from the Carney Liberals. In specific, off the top of my head, is like it would save a family of two $845 on average in a year. It's a cut of a 1 percentage point to the lowest marginal tax rate, whereas the Conservatives are offering much deeper cuts. But how could either of those main leading parties get to 2 or even 3% GDP for military spending while taking money away from government fundraising? How do you think they can circle that square when the rubber meets the road?
No, and they can't. And of course, that military is not even the only massive expenditures we need to make. We have an aging population, so we have critical healthcare needs, long-term care facility needs. But we're also in a position that there is a host of talent seeking exit of the United States. And we are currently starving the number one driver of research in this country, and that is universities. Provinces have cut back dramatically in operational budgets. Other provinces have capped or frozen or even cut and frozen tuition. And universities across Canada, and particularly in Ontario, where most of them are now in the position of dramatic cuts. So we're missing this amazing opportunity to attract talent by not investing in one of the main drivers of the economy, which is research and development and knowledge. And that's not to mention the fact that we are going to have a recession imposed on us by Donald Trump and his tariff activity. And that will mean necessarily spending to support people and industry through what could be a pretty severe financial crisis as well. So the idea that cutting taxes is going to be at all helpful is kind of maddening at this stage. And I feel like when I'm still a little bit optimistic or naive, I still feel like Canadians have rallied around the flag here. And this is a lost opportunity on behalf of our leaders to really think beyond narrow ideological mindsets that they've been ingrained in, and realize that we're in a moment here, a critical moment for the future of the country, and things have to change. And that requires investment across a whole range of things.
And so spell out some of those investments. How do we adopt a warlike effort? So one of them would be to expand on attracting brains, to instead reverse the brain drain and call it a great Canadian brain gain, I guess. What are some other ways that we can build?
I mean, I think so much of our trade is north-south and along that U.S.-Canada border. That although I'm not an expert on trade or international relations, my sense is we need serious investment in infrastructure to engage in east-west trade. I know there are already efforts underway after decades of promises to reduce and eliminate internal trade barriers between provinces. But we also need the capacity to get more and more, a greater share of goods in and out from ports rather than through or to and from the United States. When you look at a rail map on this country, we really only have, in a lot of parts of the country, a single east-west rail line. We have not invested, I think, in port capacity to really dramatically increase the volume of things going through those ports. And we may have to think about and have some serious conversations about the oil industry and oil exporting and pipeline development. And, you know, I know I have seen the parties talk about reducing wait times for the approval of new projects, but we still have to keep our eye on the ball of what the long-term destiny for the oil industry is. And we should still, despite abandoning sensible climate change policy, we still need to think about climate change within all of this. And so there are scholars who have proposed quite publicly that we need a royal commission to engage on some of the longer-term dimensions of this, to have really expert-driven policy proposals across a whole wide broad array of areas, from political and diplomatic approaches to the global decline in democracy and specifically to the threat of the United States, but also along economic lines, along the knowledge sector, along military and how to really approach even things like major procurement in the new global trading system. What domestic industries need to be built here to ensure that Canada is a little more self-sustainable? We are very vulnerable. You know, one of the things that made me nervous about Doug Ford's threats to the United States with cutting off electricity is, if it ever got there, there are things that, of course, the United States can do to us short of military threats that would be devastating, in that we get so much of our food from the United States of America, even though we have enormous capacity domestically. And there are things we could do to dramatically enhance domestic food production in areas where, particularly in areas where a lot of the stuff we import from, like California, in terms of produce, could be produced here if we invested in larger greenhouse systems and stuff that would get us through. And there's a host of other, I mean, we learned during the pandemic, just to throw out another quick example, that we don't really have domestic medicine manufacturing in key areas. So there are probably some, and again, as a non-expert in some of these things, there's probably a whole host of things I'm not even thinking about where something like a Royal Commission might be really useful, because politicians probably aren't aware of everything they need to be doing either.
Well, ever since you mentioned the one rail line that crisscrosses Canada in most places, I've had stuck in my head that I would like to tell the Royal Commission, bullet trains now. But Dr. McFarlane, anything that you'd like to add that I haven't thought to query?
No, I mean, I think at the level of politics, I really wish people would abandon the naive, bizarre assumption that there's any strategy behind what Trump is doing. He is a chaos agent. And I think more worrying than Trump himself is the fact that roughly half of the American population was willing to elect him, that he has captured the entire political apparatus of one of the only two viable political parties in that country. And that is why the idea that we're going to negotiate, or even more absurdly, deepen our relations with America, it should be a non-starter. It should scare everyone who even hears that as a proposition, because they have demonstrated that they actually aren't all that committed to the rule of law or democracy in that country. And we have, you know, I grew up thinking of the United States as our closest ally. I grew up, I was born in 1980, through the 80s, 90s, and early aughts. Never had any qualms about that relationship. And that's because it seemed to be a, you know, for all of its problems and the differences between Canada and the United States, it seemed to be a democracy and a relatively healthy one at that. How much more evidence do we need that they are no longer that? And that's where I leave it. I think we need to grow up. I think our politicians need to act with more urgency and more seriousness and more principle. And I'm worried the longer we delay that, the weaker our prospects as a country will be.
Folks, we need Fortress ANCAM. Let's get right into the belly of the beast.
That's the little Doug Ford for you. Sorry. Yeah. Anyway, what are you working on lately, and where can folks find you, Dr. McFarlane, should they like to follow along?
So I have in terms of following me, I have a Substack newsletter called Defending Canadian Democracy. I'm on Blue Sky, tweeting most days and trying not to tweet too much. Probably shouldn't say tweet, but post. And during my sabbatical, I'm working on two major projects. One, I'm writing a book with a friend and colleague, Phil Lagasse at Carleton University. We're writing a book on Canada's unwritten constitution. So all of the kind of conventions, practices, norms, and customs that really make democracy work in Canada, and how that relates to the legal and the written constitution. And then I'm working on a long-term project that's supported by a Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council grant to study the regulation of hate speech in Canada, the United Kingdom, New Zealand, and Australia. And so I'll be doing some field work in those countries throughout the year.
Dr. Emmett McFarlane can be found on Blue Sky at emmettmcfarlane.com, and his Substack titled Defending Canadian Democracy is at emmettmcfarlane.substack.com. All right, I disagree wholeheartedly with my next guest. I find the idea of conscription to the military abhorrent. I think Crawford Killian, who opined on this subject in the Tie-In and will be joining us after this break, isn't in love with the idea either, but argues that we someday may not have much of a choice. That's next. This is Sovereign Canada. It's no secret that the Canadian Armed Forces has a numbers problem. Canada spends 1.3% of its GDP on the military, falling short of NATO's members' target guideline of 2% GDP. In terms of personnel, as of 2023, the forces had in its ranks 68,000 active professional volunteers and another 27,000 reserves. And with U.S. President Donald Trump openly discussing territorial expansion, including near-daily musings about annexing Canada, Some folks are wondering if the CAF has what it takes to put up a fight, should it come to that. My next guest is a Canadian novelist in the realm of fantasy, sci-fi, and nonfiction, a former college professor at Capilano College from its inaugural year up until just before it was redesignated Capilano University in 2008, and has written as a columnist for the Vancouver Province newspaper. And lately, he's been publishing his opinions as a part-time writer and editor at The Tie, where a recent piece using the art of a provocative headline and opening lead probes this very question, titled My Case for Conscription in Canada. And if you stopped reading right there, you may have missed some of the nuance that our guest Crawford Killian would have later brought to the conversation. I'm pleased to welcome Crawford to Sovereign Canada.
Glad to be here.
So yeah, in your piece, you open up with, quote, "I'll be blunt. After 80 long years, we need to bring back conscription and fast. But I'm not in love with the idea." So for folks who closed that article as soon as they saw the conscription word, the big C word, and then skipped the rest, or maybe didn't even open the article altogether, they may have missed the "I'm not in love with the idea" part. You were in the U.S. Army. I believe you actually volunteered to avoid the draft, but can you expand on your thesis of your piece and sort of some of the sure. the nuance hither and yon?
Yeah. Okay. Well, what I was trying to argue was that conscription has always been a thorny issue in Canada. We had riots in World War I over it. We had an actual mutiny in World War II, at a military camp in Terrace, with conscripts who were afraid they were going to be shipped overseas to fight Japan. And we were very quick to get rid of conscription after the war, whereas the Americans carried on with it until the 1970s. The value of conscription chiefly is in encouraging volunteers. The U.S. Army, for example, would set up the draft, and you knew you'd be going into the Army, and they would decide what you'd do for the next 2 years. If you signed up, you could take your pick of Army, Navy, Air Force, and you could even specify the training you wanted to get. So this was an encouragement for people who were also looking for post-military careers, and it worked pretty darn well. So a lot of people signed up and got excellent training, and they were encouraged by the fact that if they didn't, they'd be drafted and take their chances. Something like that could work again here, so that people who are kind of thinking about the military would think more seriously about, hey, I want to get this particular kind of skill set, and I've got to go in the Royal Canadian Air Force to do it. Okay, that helps certainly with the recruitment. Retention is another story, but if it's done, if the working conditions of the military are good enough, you do get people who re-up and continue until they've built a pretty good career with an early retirement age, just like that.
Well, that leads me then to wonder, as we've seen these threats from Trump escalate and escalate, a lot of folks have pointed to things like Google searches for how to join the Canadian Armed Forces have skyrocketed, and how to buy a gun has also skyrocketed. So it seems to me that that motive is already starting to build within the population. Do you still think that even with people willing to volunteer to put their lives on the line, that building up, do we even need a conscription or a draft to do this?
If the threat was very close and very understandable, you wouldn't need conscription, at least at first. You'd get a mob of people swarming in to sign up, just the way they did in September of 1914 or September of 1939. They would see, okay, clear and present danger, I've got to sign up. The problem in both wars came with the sheer attrition that the wars cost, so that eventually the Canadian forces in World War I and World War II could not continue unless they got more people in, and they and the pool of volunteers was now much smaller. And when, in the case of the U.S., the sheer size of the armed forces required conscription, because you could not get enough people just volunteering.
And you're a veteran of the U.S. Armed Forces, Crawford. What was your experience like, and how did you come to that?
I volunteered for the draft just to get it over with sooner. I didn't know what they were going to do with me. I went through basic training. I got told to go to another company at the same base. They gave me a typing test, and they made me a hired killer clerk typist. And I sat behind an IBM Electric typewriter and cut a lot of orders, sending people all over the world.
I see. It's an interesting idea. I'll admit, I hate it. I don't love the idea of conscription, but I also have also lived in a completely, relatively peaceful time, so I probably don't quite have the perspective required to truly unpack the idea, right?
Yeah.
So what do you say to people who are just totally repulsed by this idea?
I understand their feelings perfectly well, and I shared them for much of my youth. Once you're actually in the Army, you have real reason to dislike it in many ways, even if it's pretty good duty, but it's also quite survivable. Otherwise, again, it's just too bad we don't have a reasonable government south of us. Now we have what seems like a complete, well, a rapidly becoming fascist government, and they are making noises about this. And one thing we've learned is that when Trump makes noises, he means it. So whether it's Greenland or Panama or Canada, he's eventually going to try to act on it. In that case, then, we need to beef up our own military to at least provide the appearance of some kind of deterrent. And we're not that out of balance, really, with the U.S. The Russians are a lot bigger militarily than the Ukrainians, and they're still at it 3 years, you know, after about 3 years of combat. And the Americans have famously bogged down in places like Iraq and Vietnam. So all we need to do is to hang on long enough to make Americans decide this war was a big mistake. And again, the idea is really to prevent that war by making it look politically unpalatable to the government in Washington.
Yeah, and some of the things that we could do to build up the military now would be what? How could we entice people to serve the country today before it gets to that?
I do it in two ways. One would be to give them a choice between going in the military and perhaps getting some technical skills or trade skills, or going into some kind of civil defense organization, which would be federal and which would put people, say, from BC in Labrador or vice versa, to work on preparing for any kind of disaster, whether it was a war or a wildfire or a flood, because we're going to have a lot of that going on at the same time we're getting all these uproars from the Americans. So you could do something far more constructive just by going into the civil defense field. One way or another, you would also be encouraging enough volunteers to add to the forces of the Canadian forces, and again present a somewhat more respectable threat to anyone who wanted to mess with us.
Well, it's a pretty thorny subject, Crawford, and I appreciate you taking the time to explain your point of view to us. I still got to say I hate it. I don't love it much, but nonetheless, I appreciate your time. And I just want to offer you the opportunity to let folks know where they can find your work going forward, so if they want to read your stuff in the future.
Just look for me at the tie.ca, and I'm there about three times a month.
Super. Awesome. Thanks so much for your time, Crawford.
It's been a pleasure.
Special thanks to Crawford Killian of the Tyee and to Dr. Emmett McFarlane, enjoying his sabbatical from teaching in the poli-sci department at the University of Waterloo. And a big thanks to you for listening. Here's a brief programming note, though, for you. It's really tough for me to give you this news. I have to put this show on what will be a hopefully brief hiatus, as we're working on moving in my family and have yet to find a new place to live. But it is something that I'm hoping to have resolved really soon, because having all of that up in the air kind of bites, and it's just something that has to be dealt with before I can continue carrying on with this show. I'm going to be bringing it back ASAP so that we can continue to have these conversations. That's my commitment to you, and thank you for all of your support to date. This isn't the end of the road. This is just a minor interruption. Sovereign Canada is written, produced, and created by me, Mike McCullough. The theme music is also my doing. You can sign up for the Sovereign Canada newsletter at sovereigncanada.fyi, where you'll find all the past shows. And you can follow me on Blue Sky. My handle is vancitymike.com. You can also shoot me an email, mike@sovereigncanada.fyi. And I'm hoping it'll be quicker than later. We got to get these shows continued. And when we do, I'll talk to you then. Until next time.
This is Bird Note. Imagine you're camping in the mountains, surrounded by pines, larch, and spruce. The very first bird you might see is a Canada jay as it boldly swoops down into your camp. This handsome jay has a smoky gray back and wings, silver gray underparts, a tiny black beak, and big black eyes that seem to miss nothing, especially food. But the one food Canada jays don't eat is conifer seeds. So why do they live in conifer forests? It turns out the jays hide food in conifer needles and tuck it under the bark of trees with their sticky saliva. Like other jays that cache food, Canada jays have terrific visual memories. They can find thousands of hidden tidbits months later. Canada jays are so good at storing up food, they even start nesting before the winter ends. The jays can feed their nestlings entirely from the food they've stored away. And unlike most other birds that nest in spring and summer, Canada jays spend that time caching food for the next winter. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann. Bird Note's newsletter delivers the wonder and joy of birds directly to your inbox. Sign up at birdnote.org to get a weekly preview of our shows, stories, photos, and more.